Have you ever thought of what is our greatest responsibility? Through the Bible, we are taught how to live, our duties, our responsibilities, what is right, what is wrong. God gives us a choice, though, on how to live our lives, but he does warn us of the dangers in the paths we can choose. The heading at the start of Deuteronomy 6 is the greatest commandment. It's also where I see our, my greatest duty, to teach our children God's way. Please turn to Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6, let's go with, start in verse 4. And put a marker here, because we'll be back and forth out of Deuteronomy 6 a little bit. This passage just doesn't give us instruction on what we as parents and grandparents should be doing, but also the when and the how. It's always easier to put something into place when you know when you should be doing it and how you should be doing it. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lay down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as a frontlet between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Have you ever considered how much this commandment to teach our children his way affects our own path? Well, today, we are going to examine how we are told to teach our children and how the way we are told to do so focuses us with greater strength on how to follow God. To see the who, what, and where of this instruction in black and white. To teach our children God's statutes and his judgments. To do so throughout the day and wherever and whatever we happen to be doing. To do so with one child or with multiple children. Often the lesson hits stronger, though, in one-on-one situations. I used to be a scout leader. I can remember as a scout leader, I would practice for I was going to be teaching the scouts. You know, I'd sit down the week before, the night before, and I'd practice something. If I was teaching them how to do a knot they had never learned before, I would work on that knot. Can remember one night before a meeting, of Joshua was a Cub Scout at that point, and he seemed really down. And at first it didn't click into my head what was wrong, because Joshua enjoyed scout meetings. I'm practicing knots. I'm going to teach them all knots. And I asked him, you know, what's wrong? And he just held up his right arm. It was in a cast. He had broken his arm. And he was thinking about how I'm about to teach everybody the next night how to do these things, and he wasn't going to be able to do it. So at that moment in time, I realized that I needed to take some time with him. And individually, we went through all of the knots we were going to learn the next day. And the one in particular I can remember was the bowline. It's a great knot. You know, if you throw someone a safety line, you throw them a bowline because you make a loop and it doesn't slide. So you can tuck it under your arms. It's not going to cause problems. And to this day, when Joshua ties this knot, he ties it left-handed because when he learned to do the knot, he learned it left-handed. I'm not even sure he can tie it right-handed without really having to think hard about it. Now, as members of our church family and followers of Christ, the positions we need to fill, and not just for our youth, but also here for those of our family, we need to be thinking like this. There are a myriad of needs that we have in this room, things that we have to fill. Some of us can help those who need help physically. You know, be the muscles of the local congregation. Some are great organizers. You know, they're the ones that inspire and they organize others to deal with the needs of individuals. Some preach from the pulpit. Some instruct more informally, but in just as important a matter, once again, one-on-one, not up here, but out in the family. You know, giving advice to others. Some are an oasis of peace, calming, calming our family's stresses, perhaps even lifting spirits that were flagging. People can fill any number of these vital needs, and they can fill more than one. We just need to be attentive to those around us. You know, in doing so, through our actions, we're modeling to the youth how to serve. Teaching with actions and not just words. It's a strong way to teach. The example of how you live and how you act has a far wider ranging effect than you might think. My children know how often I have failed to follow what I've taught them, how sometimes my words don't match my actions. So who do I have to use as positive examples? You. We parents might be the main teachers in our own families' lives, but we're not the only ones. But those in our church family, you can strengthen our children's walks at the same time you strengthen ours and you strengthen your own. Strengthen our connection with God and with the congregation. Please turn to Titus 2. Here in Titus 2, we are given a picture of not just how a family should function, but this is how we as a church should be, and frankly, how the world as a whole should function. Sadly, it doesn't. Titus 2, verses 1 through 8. But as for you, speak the things which are proper for sound doctrine. That older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound in faith, in love, in patience. The older women likewise, that they be reverent in behavior, not slanderers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things. That they admonish the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. To be discreet, chaste homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God might not be blasphemed. Likewise, exhort the young men to be sober-minded, in all things showing yourself to be a pattern of good works, in doctrine, showing integrity, reverence, incorruptibility, sound speech that cannot be condemned, that one who is an opponent may be ashamed, having nothing evil to say of you. Now, I've often looked at verse 4 and thought, people usually marry and have children, they used to in their 20s, now it's in their 30s. So this verse could deal with older people teaching those in their 20s and 30s even. But some people marry younger, some people marry older. I know I noticed something. You know, there is no age restriction in this verse. There's nothing that says this is how old you should be, how old you should be to teach, how old you are once you no longer have to teach in this way. This means when I speak to someone younger than me, I am the aged man in verse 2. While those men in previous generation, I'm still the one who is learning. I honestly often still learn from some of those of us in our 30s in this congregation. Some deep thinkers out there. You can fall into somewhat really deep conversations by just walking up to our young adults. The same way the 20-somethings who staff our church camps have that position of responsibility to God. How they act when they're in authority at camp. In some ways, they have an oversized influence on our youth. You know, they are in the position of authority, But at the same time, they're not so much older that the teens can't see themselves in their 20s. Where it's really hard as a teenager to look at someone in their 50s and go, I can see how I got there. So the young staff, they're the next stage. The person they could be in just a few short years. When they look at those of us who are farther away in age, they might not understand, like I said, how we got where we are. I don't always comprehend how I got where I am. The older staff have the same position towards the younger staff at camp. You know, those who are in positions where they need to be watching, because people are watching. They're watching to see their path forward. Yeah. And we can make it clear for them, or we can make it seem like a wilderness. You know, there's pain and loss in trying to travel any path but God's. Please turn back to Deuteronomy 6. That's why we are all an example to those younger than ourselves, either a positive or a negative example. As for a path, we'll be judged by how we affect those younger than us, or frankly, how we influence any of those around us. What Deuteronomy 6:7 is saying here is to be teaching God in his way at all times and everywhere. You teach them diligently to your children and talk to them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lay down, and when you rise up. There's a term for this kind of learning. It's called immersive learning. The world defines immersive learning as using an artificial or especially modeled environment to fully immerse the learner in an educational process. One example of this kind of learning is those who move to a different country where people don't speak the language that you normally speak. You have to, if you're going to communicate, you have to learn. Please turn to Deuteronomy 11. Why is it so important to try and put our youth in this kind of immersive environment? Because they are already immersed in the world. Satan is always trying to pull us off balance. He's trying to pull on them just as hard. The world is always willing to teach messages contrary to God's way of life and contrary to God's plan. We need to be there to give an alternative vision. But if we don't focus on what we should be teaching them, we won't like what they learn from us. Deuteronomy 11, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, you shall love the Lord your God and keep his charge, his statutes, his judgments, and his commandments always. Know today, I do not speak with your children who have not known, who have not seen the chastening of the Lord your God, his greatness and his mighty hand and his outstretched arm. Now in verses 3 through 6, Moses lists the actions God has taken to bring Israel from captivity to where they were when we go back and read in verse 7. But your eyes have seen every great act of the Lord which he did. Now, we haven't lived through this experience that he's talking about. We didn't live through verses 3 through 6. But we have seen brothers and sisters suffer. Seen them fall away, falter, and sometimes overcome and return. We should sorrow for those who we've lost. We should have joy for those who overcome. Let's turn back to Titus 2:2. We have seen the hand of God in our lives, in others' lives. We've seen the short-term pain that can sometimes come from following his way. We've seen the long-term pain that comes from following Satan. Looking back to verse 2, God says he isn't speaking to our children. Whose job is it then? It's the duty of us, those of us who are older, who have a more experienced life, who have seen things that we don't want our kids to see, have experienced things that we'd rather not have them experience. How does Titus describe the men, how they should be? That the older men be sober, reverent, temperate, sound of faith, in love, and in patience. Now, sober here doesn't mean not drunk. It means we should be vigilant. We should be watchful for dangers. Grave doesn't mean walking around with a frown. It means honorable or honest. Someone that can be trusted. To be temperate is to be self-controlled in opinion and in passion. Sound in faith and an active belief in God. Because faith needs action. In love or how you treat others, and in your patience, actions. This is in patience as I'm going to grit my teeth and get through this, but also includes cheerful endurance. I'm still fighting to internalize that point. There are times I'm enduring and doing what I need to do, but complaining, just like an Israelite. I remember someone in authority telling me, "Mike, I just love your positive attitude." He was being sarcastic. He was also right. It's not what we need to be to guide those younger than us. They can see that attitude. It makes it hard to teach if we act contrary to our own words. It can lead to doubt of what we are teaching. Looking down to Titus 2, verses 11 through 13, we can see part of that message. For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age, looking for the blessed hope and the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. These are not always easy concepts for adults, let alone those of us who are children or young adults who are influenced by the world in a dramatically stronger fashion. And their uncontrolled emotions. Delayed gratification is not popular in the world. This is a saying that there's a better way and teaching it with... This is saying there's a better way and then teaching it with authority. Please turn back to Deuteronomy 6, 7. Hopefully you did keep it marked. And thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children, and teach them all the time. In order to teach the way that Deuteronomy 6, 7 and Titus 2 tell us, we are not just looking at immersive learning, which is about the student. Yeah. If you're learning, you are a student. We are looking at immersive teaching, which is about us. It's about those who are teaching. Because to be ready to teach like this, we teachers need to not just know how we should model God's plan, we need to have prepared to do so ahead of time. A teacher needs to know how they are teaching before they get up in front of their class. Now, I remember times when I had we had a teacher that was sick and you had a substitute come in. Sometimes it'd be a teacher who understood the subject that we were talking about. Math teacher for geometry. But sometimes you'd get an English teacher for biology. Yeah. And then they're just a placeholder. They're just filling in. Even those who knew the subject that they were talking about didn't know the individuals in the class. They didn't know the comprehension of the subject they were teaching. Those substitutes are not preparing to teach us, not what we needed to learn. In some cases, they didn't know what we needed to learn. When I was teaching Joshua and my other scouts how to tie knots or anything else, I didn't rely on what I remembered. I practiced and made sure I knew or relearned what I had to teach them, that I understood the lesson. We cannot be seen as placeholders or those who have not prepared to teach righteously because we'll lose authority. We should be working to understand how we are told to teach our youth. Again, parents have their place in training up the next generation, but being a mentor to someone who you see needs you can be vital, and any one of us can do that. You know, I was almost 30 years old when I joined this congregation. And I can think of four men that I consider to be vitally important in my growth as a Christian servant, as a teacher. Each of them internalized God's way of life. Fay, Fowler, Long, Pickett. Names of men who affected how an almost 30-year-old man changed and grew. Men who served with that cheerful endurance that I mentioned, that we saw in Titus 2. They're all gone, but their influence on us is not. Their influence on our congregation lives. They were in no way the only examples of this, but they were the four that touched me the strongest. Now, Chet Fowler was the first man who ever looked at me and asked me to take a position of authority, or responsibility, I guess it should be. He was my crew leader. And one day he came up to me and said, "Mike, I'm not going to be able to be at church for a while. I'm sick. Can you take over until I come back?" And honestly, I thought he should have asked the other man who was serving with us. But I said yes. The last time I saw Chet, I yelled at him. I'm sitting in his trailer next to him when we're talking. I looked over at him, and he was less than half the man he had been. And I looked at him, I said, "Chet, when you asked me to take over till you came back, you didn't say we were waiting for the kingdom." Now, Jack Long was another one I got to learn from the longest. He taught me so subtly. At first, I didn't realize he was teaching me. You know, my favorite memory from all of our church picnics, you know, I love sports and I love talking. My favorite memory of our church picnic is standing flipping burgers at a great big grill with Jack. Spending an hour, you know, over an hour just talking between the two of us. Even when his health meant he could no longer physically serve, he and Mr. Pickett were my touchstones on how to serve. They calmed me when I was stressed and guided me when I ran into things that were new to me. Because they'd been doing the same duties I'd been doing. I'd learned from them. They showed, among other things, joy in serving others, like I said, which is certainly a godly trait and one of those that we should all emulate. The key to that kind of teaching is immersive living. We had immersive learning, we had immersive teaching, and now we have immersive living. Immersive living is what strengthens our own walk. It's the next step in building a path to a truth that what we are teaching. We're no longer teaching through words, like I said, but through our actions and through our lives. If we're doing it right, we really don't have to think about it most of the time. We have to pray about it a lot because we can't do it on our own. We need God's help. To be trying to live a lifestyle that's immersed in God and His law is required to properly teach. People who are leaders in the world will often tell you what you are doing wrong. And they'll tell you how to live your life. But when you examine their lives, you realize they aren't following the rules they espouse. The way we live our lives is how we should teach our children. After all, how do you internalize something without living it? We don't. The men whose names I mentioned, they were striving to live God's way in their words as best that they could. Understand, even those who have died and are not with us here are not free of this responsibility. Those who rise in the first resurrection, guess what? They have that responsibility towards the rest of the world. You know, because the rest of the world didn't have the necessary understanding or teaching. There's a phrase I think we all know that shows the difference between teaching how to live and living what you are saying. Do as I say, not as I do. I think we'd have all points in our lives where we've probably either said this or had someone say it to us. You know, either been the adult or been listening to the adult in that kind of situation. Since none of us are perfect, how do we handle these situations affects our children? Remember, we're always teaching our children something. It could be bad, it could be good, but always teaching. Children see us fail. Mine have seen me at my worst. They need to see us overcoming our faults. Using a time where they have seen us in the wrong and holding ourselves accountable, admitting our wrong, then explaining how we could have handled something better. It's not comfortable. But it's a positive example. To act in a different manner, say brushing off a bad reaction in front of those who are learning from us how to live their lives, well, we can have catastrophic effects on our own authority, as well as putting their development in God's family at risk. I want to go to two scriptures and pull them together because they do work together to show my point. Please turn to Exodus 20, verse 7. Here in Exodus 20, verse 7, we find the first scripture I want to highlight. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Now I'm going to jump immediately to Matthew 18:6. One of the ways we take the Lord's name in vain is by telling those around us that we are his followers in obvious fashion, but not living the life we espouse is required of his people. To me, not trying to live the life we say is needed is to be a hypocrite. To teach while acting differently is to take the Lord's name in vain. Now, Matthew 18:6. But who shall offend one of these little ones which believes in me? It would be better for him the millstone were hanged about his neck and that he were drowned in the depths of the sea. It's a vivid image. The New King James say, whoever caused one of those little ones who believe in me to sin. We can do this. Actually, we probably will do this. But certainly if we're not trying to live the way we tell them that we should be, we will do this. Offend or cause them to sin by seemingly not living up to our own words. We might tell ourselves, I'm trying to live God's way. Doesn't that mean I have to open every one of my misjudgments, every blunder, all my sins to my children and those around me? No, there are times, perhaps most of the time, to hide things from children. They're not old enough. Just as we hide much of what we deal with as adults. when you have stresses at home, you don't let your children know that there are problems if you don't have to. It doesn't help. We don't expose stresses in our life to our children, the ones that we as adults are dealing with, paying bills, work problems, etc. But we do need to do so when it affects others' walks with God. To explain why, it's simple. How do we know the difference between someone who is trying to follow God and fails, and someone who says they are trying to follow God? How do you know? That person knows, but you don't, except by the fruits they show. Well, the main reason I have found in myself to cover my faults and my sins is pride. When I look back at the fruits of the Spirit in Galatians 5, 22 and 23, oddly enough, pride is not included. Neither is fear, another reason for covering our faults. Proverbs 16, 18 says, instead we are told pride comes before a fall. And 1 John 4, 18, there is no fear in love, that perfect love casts out fear. So we need to pause. We need to cast out our fear and cast out our pride of criticism from our teaching. To teach how we live with love. In doing so, we not just help others to grow in a godly life, in a godly way, but we strengthen our own walk. Because in order to do so, we need to pull even closer to God. Because we can't do it on our own. But to do the opposite, well, as the phrase is, the cover-up will often be worse than the sin. It will weaken our authority to teach what is in the Bible, to teach the way of life that we need to teach. To teach that way and not admit our faults is a minimum confusing, because it will confuse our children. At worst, it can harm those who are watching and learning from us, and it can harm our own walk. So part of immersive teaching is coming clean to our younger family members that we, too, are fighting with human nature. And no, not always winning, but always picking ourselves up and striving to repent, to refocus, to draw back closer to God. It's a vital lesson for our youth, because they can see that we're not perfect. And they know they're not perfect. So they have to be able to see how to move in the right direction. Aristotle said, "You are what you repeatedly do." How we live our lives teaches much louder, and louder than the words we speak. But if we are always preparing to speak and always teach God, we have internalized that way. Remember, one of the definitions of immersive living is an artificial environment. That won't work. That is, again, why we need to be living God's way as immersively as we can. Because only in living that immersive lifestyle can we be seen to living and teaching that way. That's how we teach our children God's way, and that we fear and we love God. Because we have woven it through our lives and into our hearts. It shows in the work of our hands. In a way we can course correct ourselves, that those hands are about God's work. It shows in a way others can see our households have his law written so strong in our gates that they can see the difference. Yeah. One of the most effective ways we can model this is, again, to not just try and live as followers of God in Christ, but to show it. Deuteronomy 6, 8, "And you shall bind them for a sign upon thy hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thy eyes. Write them on the posts of thy house and on thy gates." What are we binding on our hands? God's statutes, His judgments, His way of life, and the love we have for God in His way. That doesn't mean we're wearing a bracelet, you know, one of those "what would Jesus do" bracelets around our wrist. You can buy a bracelet nowadays with the entire Bible engraved on it. This is different. It means we're focused on how we live, that our hands do what is right, or at least as close to what we can as to what God tells us to do. Not that we have a reminder of the law hanging between our eyes, you know, the frontlets. But instead, we try to examine everything that we do and we see through what God tells us to do, through His commandments, before we act. They've written God's way on the doorposts of our house. Well, it can be seen. The way we live can be seen by others. It's on the doorposts of our family. We walk through the doors. That's the way we live. It's in our personal families. It's in our church family. People walk through the door and they can see. That's how we teach our children God's way. Like I said, it shows in the work of our hands. It shows in the way we look through the world and through the prism of His vision. Shows in the way others can see our households have His law written so strongly in our gates that they can see the difference. Shows in the way we love and support those of us here, we support our congregational family. We're modeling that man and that woman from Titus 2. Because remember, we are always teaching our youth. It comes down to how and what are we teaching them. Let's teach them to immerse the way they live in God, in His way, rather than the world and its path. We teach them this by doing it first, by living it first, and doing it in a way that brings honor to our Father. Deuteronomy 6:5, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might." Live it and teach it.